All right, everyone, let's take our seats. How are you guys doing? It's been a long day. You hanging in there?
Yep.
You've enjoyed the session so far, hopefully?
Yes.
Been useful, praise God. We do hope to do this every year, and we trust that the Lord will use it in the lives of our churches. Well, let's turn to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 4. Let's just commit this session to the Lord. Our gracious God and Father, we come now, Lord, to the end of a long day, a day, Lord, where we've had to do a lot of soul searching. We've had to look inward, Lord, where you have searched us and known us and shown us the many wicked ways that are within us. Lord, we confess these before you. And Lord, we ask for your grace to be applied in our hearts, not only for forgiveness, but for change. And now, Lord, we ask for your help in this last session, that, Lord, as we talk about the matters of living in a digital age, and the challenges presented to parents. Father, we ask for your sustaining and for wisdom. In Jesus' name, amen. The book of Proverbs is written for children. They've got a whole book in the Bible just for them. It deals with those necessary life skills like choosing the right friends, seeing the importance of hard work, avoiding sexual temptation, the dangers of alcohol, the power of the town, you name it, it's all in there. But it's also written from the perspective of a parent to a child. So, for example, Proverbs 1 verse 10 says, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent." The book of Proverbs is God putting words in your mouth. Words that you are to utter into the lives of your children. It teaches a worldview where the most important thing is the fear of God, which is the beginning of wisdom. It teaches us about cause and effect. It preemptively makes us aware of the big temptations that lie ahead of us and the path of safety through them. It emphasizes the importance of listening to parents, of seeking knowledge and instruction. But the topic I want to direct our attention to today is the importance of guarding our hearts. So go to Proverbs 4, verse 23. A well-known verse, but very useful for us as we consider living in the digital age. "Keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life." The lives that we live and that our children live flow from the state of our hearts. This is a fundamental truth to be aware of because we have enemies within and without. Our hearts are fickle and deceitful, and this is made worse by the sinful environment that we're often subjected to. So the book of Proverbs seeks to impress upon us as children and parents the importance of the heart. This is a word that we need because of the heart disease crisis that we are faced with. With the rise of the information age, and especially the digital age, the attacks upon our hearts from our devices and in the lives of our children are manifold. This is a massive topic that deserves whole books dedicated to. But my goal today is to impress upon us the importance of the heart and the importance of parents protecting their children in a digital age. So let's talk firstly about the importance of guarding the heart. The centrality of the heart can't be overemphasized. Jesus himself tells us of the importance of the heart in Luke 6, verse 43 to 45. "For no good tree bears bad fruit, nor again does a bad tree bear good fruit. For each tree is known by its fruit. For figs are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor are grapes picked from a bramble. The good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil, for out of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks." Good treasure can only come from good hearts, and bad treasure only comes from bad hearts. Our ways will be manifest, they will manifest what is in our hearts. Proverbs 14, verse 14 says, "The backslider in heart will be filled with the fruit of his ways. And a good man will be filled with the fruit of his ways." Backsliding begins where? In the heart. It is out of the heart that we live our lives. Therefore, protecting, guarding our hearts and the hearts of our children is of utmost importance. We know that unless there is a heart change in our children through the gospel, behavioral change will be fickle and fleeting. The best that we can do to change our children is restraining them with the rod and with correction and a restraining grace in their behavior. But it won't be a saving grace until the gospel changes them inwardly. So understanding the importance of the heart, we must consider then the exhortation in this verse. Look at it again. Keep your heart with all vigilance. We're told to keep our hearts. What does this word keep mean? It means to guard, means to protect. Or there's a secondary meaning. It could also mean to maintain. I love what Matthew Henry says as he talks about this verse. He talks about these two pictures. You keep your heart as you would keep a jewel, and you keep your heart as you would keep a vineyard. A jewel is precious, cannot defend itself, needs walls of protection around it. It needs guards set up about it. A vineyard needs keeping in another way. It needs sunshine, it needs rain, it needs nurture, it needs de-weeding, it needs some pruning. Those are two different types of keeping. And these are the two ways in which we are to keep our hearts. The urgency of guarding our heart is amplified in this verse. It says, with all vigilance. Like a guard on the city wall looking out to the horizon to see if there's an enemy approaching. With all vigilance. Now, the primary way in which you and I would keep our hearts would be in a self-regulating way, wouldn't it? We're born-again Christians. We recognize that the heart is deceitful above all things, that there's all sorts of things in the world that we have to keep ourselves safe from. So we would take preventative measures. We would stop things from going in the eye gate. We would stop things from going in the ear gate. And we'd do those positive things like a vineyard. We would nurture our hearts. We would think on the things that are good, clean, and pure. We'd meditate on the law of the Lord day and night so that it feels like we're planted by many rivers of water. But how does this apply for parents? As parents, being made aware of the sensitivity and importance of your children's heart, we have to do for them what they are not yet able to do for themselves or would not choose to do for themselves. So, you not only have to guard your own heart, parent, there is a responsibility upon you to guard your child's heart, to teach them how to guard their heart so that as they grow up into becoming responsible adults, they will then also, following your instruction, guard their hearts. So as parents, we take the authority that we've been given by God to regulate their lives for their good. God will hold parents accountable for not protecting their children. The Bible has strong warnings about those who cause little ones to stumble. Neglecting to protect our children on this front, we might as well be exposing them to temptation. Woe to those who cause these little ones to stumble. So today, my goal as we talk about technology and living in a digital age is to raise an alarm. Now, I know that each one of you is aware of the dangers of technology. I want to make that much worse today. I want you to know that you know that you know the dangers of technology, and then hopefully we can look at some positive strategies for managing that. We know that we are surrounded by a world that is not guarding its heart, and that we live in an environment where we are digitally inundated with ungodliness, and it seems impossible to live a life and bring up our children in a world like this where we can protect them from the harmful effects of technology. I mean, doesn't your child need a smartphone? My goal today is not to answer every possible question that we can touch on. This is a book-length issue. But hopefully just to inform us of the reality of the problem and to mobilize us to action. What I want to do today is to get us all on the same page about the harm of technology and a commitment to a low-tech childhood environment in our homes and our churches for our children. So just a quick word about some resources. I think three books I'd like to recommend, amongst others. Scrolling Ourselves to Death, Reclaiming Life in a Digital Age by Crossway Publications. A great book. Many different Christian contributors. Another book, and I'll be sharing quite generously from this book later on. It's a book called The Anxious Generation. How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness by Jonathan Haidt. He's a social psychologist. He is an atheist. And the value of looking at the work of an atheist is that even someone who's informed by evolution can see the detrimental impact of technology on children. And that's important because we don't want this to just be, this is not just a Christian concern. This is a human concern, and we as Christians should be doubly invested in this concern. And then the third book that I want to point you to, and if I was going to point you to one book, if you just want to buy one book to read on this issue, this is the one. It's called The Tech Exit. Exiting Tech. The Tech Exit, A Practical Guide to Freeing Kids and Teens from Smartphones by Claire Morrell. So she is a believer. She and her husband are members of Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington. She also works for the government as a consultant on how to keep children safe online. So this is a really Christianly informed worldview book, and it's highly, highly, highly practical. So the second point will be looking at Jonathan Haidt's work and just dumping some data on you. And then the last part, the practical part, I'm going to be borrowing generously from her work. And so I want to signal this here. Go and read her stuff. It's super helpful. And hopefully what I do here today will sort of encourage you to go and investigate those resources. So let's begin then. We've seen the importance of the heart. The lion's share of what we want to do today is look at the present war that is being waged on our hearts and the hearts of our children. And I do want to begin with the non-Christian perspective, Jonathan Haidt, and what he says in his book, The Anxious Generation. He begins his book with an imaginary scenario. So imagine, one day your child comes home from school, having signed up without your knowledge or your consent, to go on a mission to Mars. You learn that children have been targeted to go because they haven't yet gone through puberty, so that they'll go through puberty on Mars so that they can be more adaptable. And there's no certainty of this, but there's the hope of it. As far as you can tell, they have not taken into account the ions that will assault the developing cells of your children because of a lack of atmosphere. There has been no accounting for only 38% of Earth's gravity's impact on a child's developing body. Question to you as a parent. Would you let your children go? Are you offended that the school just didn't even ask you about whether this, did your opinion matter on this point? The leaders do not know things about child development and did not get parental permission. You would be furious. You would be up in arms and up in action. Well, this is a scenario that he uses to try and paint a picture for what's happened with technology with our children. At the turn of the millennium, many technologies were provided to take advantage of the growing internet. And it helped to some extent, didn't it? Work got a little bit better. Communication got a little bit better. We got better connected with some people who were further away. Our entertainment got better in all sorts of ways, but not all for good. Children were dragged into an online childhood to their detriment, without safety measures, without preparation, without governments properly regulating these things. Many parents allowed their children to use phones and tablets because other parents were allowing their children to use phones and tablets because the schools were using tablets and all, you know. So everyone was just on board with the new tech and talking about responsibility, but not enough. (Clears throat) technology providers, those businesses that were making these phones available and various apps available, did not research the impact of these things upon children before children were allowed access to them. Technology users also began to use manipulative techniques that kept young people glued to their screens, basically rewiring their brains, causing them to become addicted. Social media companies that deeply impact girls more than boys, and porn and games that get boys hooked, were not sufficiently regulated and were too easily and freely available online. These things damaged a whole generation's childhood when they were undergoing the most important stages of their development. Now, did you know this? That children can enter a legally binding agreement at the age of 13 with Meta, Facebook. So they're entering into a legal agreement with Meta about their data at the age of 13. This is unheard of. Allowing children at the age of 13 to enter into legal agreements. Tech companies today are more like the old oil and tobacco companies that damaged whole generations and defended their actions in the name of capitalism, even talking about the virtues of their various products. Purely from a developmental point of view, purely from a scientific point of view, not even a spiritual point of view yet, the frontal cortex, which helps with self-control, is not fully developed until the mid-20s. So children, young children, preteens, teenagers are extremely vulnerable to their brains being deeply impacted by technology. We don't allow children to drink, gamble, drive, or buy cigarettes, yet we allow them access to addictive brain-shaping technologies. Gen Z. You all know what Gen Z is? It's that generation of children that were born between 1997 and 2012, are so far the most deeply impacted generation. In their generation, they saw the growth of the internet, the introduction of social media, the introduction of personal devices, smartphones, broadband, a massive increase in pornography and internet gaming, as well as social media platforms. And these came to define the normal childhood experience of a whole generation. Think of it, 2007, the introduction of the smartphone. We're nearly 20 years next year, anniversary of the iPhone. 2009, the introduction of the like button and the share button. 2010, the introduction of front-facing cameras. And Instagram shortly thereafter. The introduction of the selfie. Gen Z went through puberty with a portal in their pockets, drawing them away from their family connections, their friend connections, the ordinary activities of childhood into an adult-oriented online world with free access to all sorts of things that were dangerous to them. Scrolling through the pages of influencers, peers who posted doctoral presentations of themselves, being targeted by algorithms, trapping them online. In 2011, 23% of teens had a smartphone. These are American statistics, but New Zealand's quite similar. So one in four teenagers had a smartphone in 2011. 5 years later, 8 out of 10 had a smartphone. And a quarter of all children between the ages of 8 and 12. 1 out of 4 children between the ages of 8 to 12 had their own smartphones. In 2015, teenagers averaged 7 hours a day on their phones, with at least 2 hours on social media. In 2022, 46% of teenagers spoke about being online continually. That means that every notification was pinging them all the time, including in the middle of the night. They were never not plugged in online through their phones. 46% of teenagers. They were the first generation to grow up on Mars. They were the first generation to have their whole childhood experience dictated to and controlled by a digital world. They were the experiment. The data is now in, and we can now measure how they have been impacted. In the early 2010s, things changed dramatically, bringing on a tidal wave of mental illness. Why was there suddenly a dramatic change between this generation and the one before? Phones. In the US, one set of data looks at those who grew up during the 2010s, and then by the time they were undergraduates, they did a few surveys. They saw a 134% increase in anxiety. And it was from a 10 to a 25% of the group. 106% increase in depression, 72% in ADHD, 57% in bipolar, 100% in anorexia, 67% increase in schizophrenia, 33% in substance abuse and addiction, all in a 10-year window. So that's basically a flat line that goes like that. From 2010, a sudden upsurge in these problems. As they compared the age range of those who were between 18 and 25 with those who were 50 plus, here's the line for 50 plus. Is the line for 18 to 25. Massive upsurge. And the question is, how did this happen? What is impacting this generation? Jonathan Haidt is interested in this data because of another book that he wrote called The Coddling of the American Mind. He and others were finding on college campuses that students in a learning environment, so on campus, at university, at their colleges, a place where alternative views should be able to be researched, discussed, debated. Suddenly, he was finding these adults derailing. Students were talking about hate crimes and violence because people weren't using the proper pronouns. They needed safe spaces. This was a generation that was suddenly seeing such a surge in anxiety and depression and suicide. And what is making a whole generation of young people so non-resilient? What is it about their childhood that may have contributed to the fact that they can't cope with what every other generation has been able to cope with before them? And so the data is in. It's the impact of technology on their childhood. And this sudden downturn occurred not just in America, but all Western countries who've had similar access to the internet, technology, devices, etc. Children have had a normal childhood stolen from them through addictive technology controlling their lives. So from a purely developmental point of view, smartphones are bad for children. They are bad for mental health. Children need to develop in the God-given way without the introduction of addictive technology. Children are constantly developed in every phase of childhood. Lays a foundation for adulthood. So what happens if you start putting devices in your children's hands at the age of 2? Now, I'm not saying there aren't educational ways of doing that. What happens if the undisciplined way in which a large part of parents are doing today allow access to all sorts of devices to their children? Technology is hijacking a child's development. So being constantly connected has led to sleep deprivation. The ordinary teenager needs how many hours of sleep? 8 to 9 hours of sleep, which is why teenagers should go to bed earlier than others. Adults need 5 to 6 hours. They are the ones who are allowed to stay up late. At least that's me. I don't need a lot. But sleep deprivation is damaging children. Of course, they're not then able to work at normal levels of function because they're not able to concentrate, they're getting irritable, all sorts of things happen just because they're not sleeping as much as they need. There's attention fragmentation. They aren't able to stay focused on one task because their attention is being called away. They say the average time spent on a TikTok screen is 3 seconds. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. That's how long the average page is stayed on before they flick to the next one. What do you think that does to the brain in terms of being able to stay focused on anything? And of course, there's the problem of addiction. Signs of addiction include irritability, isolating themselves, loss of sleep, sacrificing once loved interests, a favorite hobby, favorite sport, sacrificing friends, just letting friendships fall by the wayside because they're spending too much time online, sacrificing family and social relationships, sacrificing responsibilities, jobs, chores, anger when deprived, and you name it. We can go on listing the signs of addiction. Children need to be outside and interacting with others in play. The argument of Jonathan Haidt in his book is that play is so important for your children. The ordinary stuff that your kid just gets up to when they're with other kids is fantastic for normal, natural development. We learn basic life skills from play. Self-governance, group decision-making, how to lose, how to share, cooperative bonds with the weak and with the strong. Physical stimulation and risky play is good for your kids. Contact sports, play fighting, jumping off of heights. Excellent stuff. Despite what mom says. Homework cannot provide certain things that only play can provide. Play enables them to handle bruises, manage their emotions, resolve conflicts, play fair. These are good, normal, natural childhood things that need to happen. Social media, on the other hand, leads to a curated, not free exchanges. Falsely managed selves, not real selves, being engaged. Actions are weighed for their like factor, for their ability to trend, for how many followers it can gain, and who would approve. So the naturalness of just a child's actions are suddenly stunted as they're now starting to live to please an audience. Children learn from the feedback loop of real interactions. Deepening social relations happens through interaction, but devices interject themselves, making for distracted and interrupted relationships. Young mothers not looking at their children, but at their phones. The reading of facial expressions from person-to-person exchanges are lost. Emotional self-regulation comes from those who have rich and deep interactions with loving parents and other children. We learn our social norms from real interactions with others. Girls sing, jump ropes, do synchronous hand games. These no apparent benefit group activities do in fact benefit. They create synchrony and awareness of interacting with others. All cultures have communal dance rituals and foster belonging and identity through real world interactions with others. Social media does not enable these things. Social media sites make one a consumer or a content provider, but cannot manufacture the needed interactions that make for good social skills. We learn by copying. As children, role models are a key part in learning. Parents play a most important part, but peers and others are necessary too. Especially when a child hits around the age of apprenticeship, the age of 12, that's when they start looking for other influences that aren't mom and dad. And that's where the parents have to strategically begin to sow good influences in the lives of their kids. A Christian coach, a music teacher, all sorts of people like that that come alongside. Boys going to go work with someone to learn a great skill. Those are important roles that influence them. Children are wired to learn by imitation. So this applies itself negatively as peer pressure. But this is a God inbuilt thing, as they're supposed to model themselves on good role models. So digital childhood lacks these positive opportunities. Instead, social media feeds into the negative feedback loop of conformity bias, where children will copy what they see online in merely what they've seen in a few hours, instead of copying what their parents have taught them for a lifetime. They just see it, start doing it because everyone's copying it, because they see the group doing it. Children copy the prestigious. Those with the perceived tokens of importance, success, beauty, and prestige, instead of imitating an older brother who might be a good hunter, a father who was awarded a war medal, a mother who is loved for her cooking and her generosity, a head prefect who is respected for his diligent self-control, accomplishments in sports, and loyalty to the school, an uncle who is a skilled tradesman, Children are now attracted to people who have the most likes, and usually for antisocial behavior. They're attracted to people who have the best doctored selfies and are thought to be the most beautiful, even though those photographs have been touched up. Those who have the most drip, the most facial tattoos, young girls who are shamelessly hooking up, young men who brazenly embrace chauvinism are the people who are getting the approval of our young people. If you live in a social environment that values archery, you'll respect the best archer in the village. But online, this is not what's happening. People are now famous for being famous. And people are loved for being famous, and not for being good at anything or contributing anything. But these are the role models that we're allowing our children access to influence them, and not people in real life environments. Think of Kim Kardashian. Does everyone here know who Kim Kardashian is? Everyone heard that name? It's a sadness that we know her name. She was made famous by a sex tape. And then there was a reality show made about her. In an interview, when asked, what is one superpower that she has that no one else has? Her unique skill is she is able to smell cavities. Cavities in other people's mouths. This is her superpower. But everyone knows her. Everyone wants her body type, if you're a young woman. In the early 2010s, a generation of young girls aimed all their learning apparatus at these online role models. And just to put it in medical terms, 11 to 13 are the worst years for girls to be online, and 14 to 15 are the worst years for boys to be online. Phones are experience blockers. A smartphone creates a highly connected and information-intensive, disembodied experience of childhood. They're so varied. There's that three-second TikTok roar. There you are. You're looking at a beautiful mountainscape. Now you're looking at someone shouting at someone in public, and then you're seeing someone fall off a bike, and then there's no quality engagement. You're being taught to not pay attention to anything. So, what do we do? What do we do? That's a lot of research from Jonathan Haidt's book. Here, let me switch gears now and speak to you about Claire Morrell. And this is her book, Tech Exit. These are some positive strategies that you can think about. Claire gives an action plan of how to control tech, especially phones, in your children's lives. First, a reality check that present strategies of just trying to reduce harm and reduce time aren't working. You give your child a phone, and you go in there with the best of intentions. I'm going to have parental controls. They're only going to have it for half an hour a day. They're only going to have free access to it on the weekends. They're not going to have them in their bedrooms. They're, you know, what are the big list of rules that you have? Within 3 months, all those rules have been renegotiated. They have begged and fought and deceived themselves into new ways of having the phone and more access to their phones in their lives. Isn't that the way it goes, parents? Am I speaking the truth? So we need to be realistic about that. The second thing that she says is you need a detox, a hard fast, and this is what she recommends. You speak to your family about your intentions to go start ripping tech out of your life, and you will never get to a zero tech situation because some people need it for work and education and other purposes. But what you do is you plan a family holiday. The whole family goes away on holiday with no technology except mom and dad's phone for communication purposes. Everything else gets left behind. You talk about what you're going to do when you get back. You fill up that holiday with family fun activities, and you go back to implement a low-tech situation. That's a great way to segue into if you're wanting to do a revamp of your family lifestyle. But what she's got in her book, she outlines a 5-point plan, and it's the acronym FEAST, F-E-A-S-T. So F-E-A-S-T. So let's begin then with this five-point plan, and I don't have some points. F, find other families. Find other families. Connect with like-minded parents to build a support network and break the need for tech in social circles. What's the biggest challenge as parents? But everyone's children's got one. That's the biggest challenge, isn't it? No matter how much you try to work in your own home, it's everyone else's home that has no rules. So find other families. Mothers are usually the key implementers. Now, dads, you better be involved. You've got to be part of the discussion. You've got to be part of the decision-making. But usually, moms are spending more time enforcing. Moms always look like the bad guy. Dad always looks like the good guy. Sorry, moms. Moms are usually left to be the disciplinarians throughout the day. And she's saying, when dad gets home and dad comes in, he's calm. You know, he can just, you know, the three-point plan of discipline. You know, he engages calmly. He's the good guy at the end of it all. Mom's the bad one. So moms need other moms. Mothers need to connect with other mothers. They're usually the ones who are carrying the weight of implementation. So they're going to have to connect. Now, individual parents are finding it very difficult to change things in their family because everyone around them is doing it. So you have to do it with others. So here are some suggestions from the book. Begin with your street, your near neighbors. Hopefully you have this, and she's speaking out of American context where all the kids are riding bikes on the same street, you know, the white picket fences and all that. But this is a useful scenario. You might know your neighbors well. There might be several families on a street whose kids already play together. Find other families that also want to see their kids have tech-free opportunities to play. If you get your kids outside with a bunch of other kids outside, other kids are outside, what are they going to do? They're going to join in. And so you want to start creating those tech-free opportunities. Make small pockets of counterculture. Make your home a screen-free haven where you only pull out the screen for family movie nights or whatever the case is. Young mothers groups, women's groups, homeschooling collectives, parents in a church. These are wonderful opportunities to start small ecosystems of people who are all on the same page, who have shared values, who want to do it together. So church, you have my permission to get together and begin implementing tech-free spaces. This is a good thing. You need other families in the church. This is where the church can really help facilitate protecting childhood in a world like ours. But this will mean, of course, commitments from the parents. Parents will have to commit to giving up time to facilitating these new time-intensive fun activities with other people. It's easy to just let them watch a couple of movies for a few hours, isn't it? Let them stream their favorite cartoon for a few hours to keep them busy. Instead, parents are now going to have to sacrifice time to engage their children. Give up their homes to allow children to come over for a barbecue or come over for a games evening or to be available at 10 o'clock at night to go and pick up their kids because they've been in another kid's house and to bring them home. So there will be sacrifice involved, but these sacrifices are worth the benefits of protecting a child's upbringing. Institutions like churches and schools can minimize their use of tech. Sometimes churches, you know, well, we've got to get right up to front. Let's make all of our communications via this latest chat app. You know, everyone has to get the latest app so that everyone can be online, always have to have their phones so they can always be up to speed with the latest news. Churches can find other ways of distributing information. So that's F, find other families. E, explain, educate, exemplify. Explain, educate, exemplify. Get your children on board by explaining the why behind the change, educating them on digital dangers and modeling good behavior. Children do not automatically go along with these great ideas. They don't want to leave their phones. They don't want to be the odd one out. And so you will have to push it to some extent, but you can do that well with clear explanations, with good family discussions, with educating them on what you are doing as a family. Give clear standards Avoid authoritarianism or permissiveness. Rules should have good reasons which model good decision-making abilities that kids need to learn. Educate on the harms of social media. And it's ironic, but throughout several of the books that I've read, they all recommend a Netflix documentary called The Social Dilemma. The Social Dilemma highlights how tech companies manipulate users' data. So there is algorithmically based targeted stuff coming at you. The use of technology is not just something fun. There is an insidious motive that lies behind it that your children are not aware of. And so you can watch documentaries like that. There are TED Talks. There are podcasts. There are books that you can access and information you can get a hold of that you can discuss as a family and consume as a family so that you can all be on the same page about the problem that needs to be addressed. So that's a very important part. This education part does become important, and that's where books like The Tech Exit and others are so useful for parents. Another way to talk about the need for this with your kids is just ask your kids this question. Do you see any destructive use of phones amongst your friends? And they'll come out with the list. Oh, yeah, so-and-so looks at pornography. Oh, they spend 3 hours gaming. I mean, I just try to spend some time with a friend, and he just wouldn't get off his phone. And you know. It's very easy to come up with real examples of kids that are suffering the detrimental effects. Your children will also want to rail against the rules, and so you have to talk, listen, negotiate, reason, and be available. Don't just lay down the law. You want to take them with you in this process. Allow for reasonable exceptions. So, for example, playing game. Let's say you're a game console free home, but your children have friends where they may allow games to be played on a Friday night, and it's a Friday night. Will you allow your children to go to their house and play games on a Friday night? You can. Concessions like that, where your home is still your home, your rules are still your rules, but you're not so legalistic that you're going to try and regulate everyone else's life. You can make those small, reasonable, safe concessions. You know, if your movie night is a Friday night and now it's a Saturday night in someone else's house and they're going to someone else's house on a Saturday night, are they allowed to watch a movie then too? You know, those are the sorts of concessions that you should be willing to consider so that there's a release valve for some of the pressure that they may be feeling, that the rules seem too harsh, too rigid, too enforcing. But as part of the education process, we want to prepare our kids for danger. Even if your kids don't have phones, let's say you've got the rule they don't have phones to 16. That's a good rule. I encourage that rule. Even if they don't have phones, you still have to talk to them about the danger of what they might see on other people's phones and computers. Their friends may still have phones. And so let's say their friends turn up and they want to start showing pornography. You should have already had one recommendation is 10 before 10. 10 conversations before the age of 10 about what other kids might expose you to on their phones. You know, where you shut down, walk away, tell a parent. Shut down, walk away, tell a parent. you know, give them those pathways to prepare them for some of the things that they might encounter going forward. And of course, this is the hardest one, parents must model good usage and self-control. What is the part that the phone plays in your life? Adults are not immune to addiction. Your use of a phone might be impacting your own parental relationship with your child. Do you disrupt face-to-face communication with your child while you're having an important conversation to check a text? Or do you wait until the conversation's over to look at your phone? What has a hold of you? Does your phone have a hold of you in those sorts of situations? Some parents even go through, now they may need phones for work and other important applications, but some parents deliberately dumb down their phones as they participate in this family project of going to less technology. For example, they turn off all notifications. You don't want to be a slave to notifications. Those should be turned off. They avoid certain tempting apps. If Facebook is a problem for you, they leave the Facebook app off their phone. They may have a Facebook on their computer at home, so that they're not just using it all day, but only at choice times during the day in a disciplined way, modeling that form of discipline. Some people put apps into a folder so that it's at least a few steps away to actually opening the app. So they might, along the way, remind themselves, oh, hang on, I shouldn't just be defaulting to my phone. Another thing you can do is modeling transparent and public tech use. If there are things that you shouldn't be looking at with children looking over your shoulder, should you be looking at them? If you're using your phone in a public space, anyone should be able to walk behind you and see what you're looking at. If you have to hide your phone, I mean, that's questionable, isn't it? And so public tech use should be a general rule, where people can walk past you using your devices, knowing that you're not partaking in any questionable behavior. A, adopt alternatives. Actively replace smartphones, tablets, and video games with engaging real-life alternatives. So what do we do instead of smartphones? Well, there are such things as dumb phones. Phones that are purely for talking and testing. Texting, phones with no browsers and no app ability. Another thing to think about is, this is a question for your children, do you need to have a phone with you at all times? I grew up where phones were actually connected to walls. So I don't know how we survived. It's not an EDC. It's not an everyday carry. Phones don't have to be part of your EDC outfit. So the example is, have a family phone. Let's say one kid needs it, is going to soccer on a Tuesday and needs to phone mom to be picked up. They pick up the phone out of the basket in the kitchen and they take it with them to soccer, and then it gets left in the basket. And then on Tuesday, when Susie needs it to go to a violin lesson, they pick up the phone to go, and then they can tell their mom what time they need to be picked up, and then they put it back, and they put it back in the family basket. So there's a phone that's available for connecting for important tasks. Why do we all need a personal phone? I don't think any of us have questioned that assumption enough. So any form of phone is not a right, but it is a responsibility. And so as children get to the age where you are now allowing them to get phones, they should be earned by those who have modeled responsibility. Is your child able to keep their room clean? Are they able to be home at the right time? Are they doing their homework? Are they being nice and aware of others and their needs around the house? Why should they be given a tool which needs a lot of responsibility for it if they haven't even modeled responsibility in basic areas of life? And so you need to have that conversation that is part of your moving your child from childhood to greater degrees of adulthood, that you're discussing, are they responsible enough to have a phone? Get a landline. That's one possibility. We all used to have to try and talk to our girlfriends with our parents around. You know, you can't even close the door on the cord because it might just like kink it permanent. Those are good things. That's a level of transparency and accountability, which is good. Children at school can use the school phone. School phones are available. Phone your parents. Of course they'll allow that. If your children do have phones, no phones in bedrooms. If your kid's 18 and already working, they at least can't sleep with their phone in the bedroom. Yeah, maybe that's a concession you make for your adult children. All phones must be left somewhere else. But I need my alarm clock. Get an alarm clock. I need my phone to tell the time. Buy a watch. These are good things. They have made you addicted to your technology by making it a multi-tool, a Swiss Army knife. Don't be addicted to it. Find other things that fulfill those uses and make phones have less use in your life. And model that for your kids as well. But my child needs a phone so they can drive around. Use a map. I had to drive around Joburg with a street map. And it's full of one-way streets. Can be done. It's probably a good idea to learn how to use a map before you just start driving. I don't know. It seems wise to me that that's the case. If you allow your children to have a social media account after the age of 16 or some other wise age, it can be accessed on the family computer. So there aren't these long, secretive, dark, sinful conversations taking place that shouldn't be taking place. It's that transparent public use of technology again that we're wanting to encourage. S. Set up digital accountability screen rules. So here we are creating strict, clear boundaries and rules for technological use in the home. So here it's not a no-tech situation. We're not going Amish, we're not going Luddite, but it's a low-tech situation. So if children are allowed email addresses or phone accounts, or social media accounts, all communications must be available to be vetted by the parent. Now, let me make something very clear here. The parent is not surveilling their children. They're not watching every single move they make. But they have the right to spot check any communication at any time if they feel doubtful. That is the parent's right. No private technology use is a principle for children. You can add things like web filters. These are helpful to stop certain web browser activities, but please be aware, anything can be gotten around. AI is very helpful at helping kids to get around all sorts of... If you want to try and beat your web browser, whatever it is, ask AI to help you, and it'll give you the answer. So just know that there is no absolutely secure option, but have as many options as you can. Put levels of security to help. That's good. So let's talk about family screen rules. So here are, I think, two principles that Claire outlines, which I think are very helpful. Firstly, screen use is public and purposeful. So there's the family TV. Private tech use by children is not needed, but now we're getting to other uses. Maybe your child needs to use a computer for homework. They've got to do a Google search for an assignment. Or maybe it's they've got to buy something. They've got to do some shopping online for Father's Day or whatever it is. Okay? We want our children to know how to use computers. We want to know so they know how to use the internet. There's all sorts of opportunities to do those sorts of things. But what are some of the rules around how that gets done? So all use in those instances should be visible. Internet searching for research purposes are fine, but parents are present. No internet usage when parents are not present. So if you password protect your computer and only parents know the password, what have you done? You've guaranteed that your children will only use your computer when you're around. Those are the sort of obvious things that you can do. When your child comes to you and says, "Hey, I'd like to use the computer, please." This is a great opportunity for parents. You want your children to use computers because they're necessary for all sorts of things. You don't want to be seen to be a Scrooge. You've reminded them of the dangers. You're encouraging them to use them as a tool. And so this is your opportunity now to ask some questions. What do you want to use it for? Oh, I need to buy a thing. I need to do a Google search. How long do you need? Maybe 20, 25 minutes. Okay, and so you're able to follow this, aren't you? What you don't want is 4 hours of drifting time on the internet because it's purposeless use that gets them into trouble. If they're going onto the internet for a purpose, that's great. Let them learn how to do that and do that well. But when you're just sitting there and maybe you click on that app and maybe you open that website and just wasting the time and you're just drifting, you're just going to drift towards all sorts of things that your little dopamine searching brain wants for stimulation. If anyone's had a porn addiction, they might end up on a porn site. If you're a social media addict, you might end up on a social media platform. If you have got a shopping problem, you probably end up on you've got to go onto the internet with purpose. So do your children. So define that purpose and release and allow. And then just be present so it's not taking place in an unaccountable sort of way. This encourages the internet to be used as a tool. The second principle is this: screen entertainment is sparing and shared. Sparing and shared. TVs are used for entertainment. It is limited. You don't just turn the TV on at 6 o'clock on a Saturday morning and leave it on all day, allowing Cartoon Network to while the time away so you can sleep in. They're used in a limited way, and they're used with others. With others. So everyone doesn't get their own private screen and go sit in their own bedrooms. With others. So free access to screens for private opportunistic entertainment doesn't exist. And of course, TVs as a way to please tired toddlers is often a bad idea. There may be a time where mom has to put on a program for half an hour because it's time to cook the tea. You've got to decide how long each day you're going to allow your child to have screen time and use those screen times wisely for those sorts of purposes. Trade screens for real life responsibilities. So here, replace screen time with chores, hobbies, and community involvement. Your time should not be spent trying not to look at a screen. Your time should be spent not feeling not looking at screens, but just so busy with other stuff that you don't need a screen in your life. Family activities, interactive activities, social activities, activities involving movement and physical touch. These are all good and necessary things for childhood development. Real world responsibilities are important to cultivate as a satisfying alternative to mindless hours of entertainment. So, cleaning cars, walking pets, babysitting siblings or neighborhood kids or church kids, doing chores, earning pocket money, help them learn life skills. One family that is in the book, every new summer they learn a new chore. So when it's school holidays, the children learn to use the washing machine and hang up washing. Next holiday, now we learn how to iron. Those are just some constructive things to do. They're time killers. They're great. Then there must be real life pursuits. Homes, your home, which is primarily where your child is going to be brought up, should be places filled with musical instruments, arts and craft materials, journals for writing out their own thoughts, a library of good books, sports equipment so that kids can get active in all sorts of ways, tools that children should be allowed to have access to or power tools with dad, outdoor play spaces and indoor play spaces. There should be family outings, camping, holidays. All of these things must be in your life. If you're just too busy and you don't have these things and then you're asking your children to give up technology, they're really going to struggle. And so you need to have these alternatives. So in conclusion, very simply, as parents, we are called to guard our own hearts and the hearts of our children. We live in an information age, and we need to take extra special care in doing so. Probably used up all of our time, but let's allow some comments or questions.